What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
If we can't get Yang fixed, we're not going to buy another sibling for Mika.
It is an interior core problem. I need your permission to break open the core.
That's from the new film After Yang, which takes place in a near future where a malfunctioning techno-sapien triggers a family's existential crisis.
In my house, it's the Homo sapiens triggering the existential crises. After Yang is the follow-up to director Koganada's 2017 film and Film Spotting Golden Brick winner, Columbus. We've been looking forward to his new one for a while, and we're going to say it was worth the wait.
Yeah, we might not need another new film the rest of the year. I think we're set. Our review of After Yang and more is ahead on Film Spotting.
Welcome to Film Spotting. Let's see here. Coppola versus Malick. Spielberg versus Cassavetes. Lucas versus Scorsese. Josh, I'm not seeing a lot of easy choices in round two of Film Spotting Madness, where we are crowning the best film of the 1970s.
I mean, yeah, just reducing cinephilia to, you know, a battle royale, as it was meant to be.
That's why we call it madness. First round results and second round matchups later in the show.
But first, our review of a quiet movie that speaks volumes, After Yang.
Did Yang want to be human?
That's such a human thing to ask, isn't it?
May I be honest with you?
Wait, is not being honest an option for you?
Do you want him back?
Of course I do.
I want him back too. I just need a little more time.
In a recent New Yorker profile, Celine Sciamma's quest for a new feminist grammar of cinema, writer Elif Batuman recounts how the French director of my favorite film of 2021 used some of her own grade school notebooks as props for a scene in Petite Maman. We looked through them together that first day at the cafe, Batuman writes. In one, there was an unfinished story about a lost white dog who wants a warm house with good friends to love him. The dog encounters a series of neighborhood characters and asks if they want a good white dog for Christmas. They all decline. Tasked with writing an ending, 6-year-old Sciamma came up with one sentence. A chicken offers him her nest, and he says yes. That's the ending I want to every story, Sciamma told me. I want this ending to my story. I want the chicken. What does wanting the chicken mean exactly? It means a shift away from what has been one of the fundamental tenets of storytelling from Sophocles to Spielberg: conflict. A protagonist, usually a man, wants something, and an antagonist produces obstacles for the hero to overcome on his way to getting it. The dog needs a home and inevitably would negotiate with or scheme against the chicken. Inevitably, except not in Sciamma's work. Not anymore, anyway. Sciamma, Batuman relates, is, quote, no longer interested in making the viewer suffer, unquote. Indeed, a big reason I swoon for Petite Maman is how it subverted my expectations around dramatic conflict. An 8-year-old girl building a treehouse in the woods meets a girl her age. It is significantly more complicated and way more magical than that sounds, but it's never more confrontational, despite myriad opportunities for misunderstandings and misgivings. And that peacefulness doesn't make Petite Maman any less provocative. In fact, the opposite is true. I thought about Sciamma and her subtle form of iconoclasm a lot while watching After Yang, the new film from another quiet warrior in the fight against screen skirmishes, Koganada. Adapted by Koganada from Alexander Weinstein's short story Saying Goodbye to Yang, the film follows Colin Farrell's Jake as he searches for a way to repair his young daughter Mika's android companion, who also, notably, provides a constant connection to her Chinese heritage. Mika struggles with the loss of her babysitter-slash-older brother. Mother Kira, played by Jodie Turner-Smith, struggles with Jake's remoteness and how reliant they've become on Yang to raise their daughter. A corporation that produced Yang just might have installed him with spyware that documents what he sees and hears. A curator wants Yang for her museum. Which is all to say, Josh, there is potential for plenty of conspiratorial scenarios and contentiousness in After Yang. But Koganata leaves that potential antagonism unexplored. Was there any suffering in your experience with Yang because of the film's lack of it? Or, like Siama's chicken, did you say yes to the cinema of peaceful provocation?
I think you described Petite Mama as complicated and magical, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yes, this is fairly conflict averse, but I wouldn't say that it is uncomplicated, and it is absolutely magical. You mm-hmm. mentioned Spielberg as well, and we have the Spielberg version of this, right? AI, artificial intelligence, which is many things. In my book, one of Spielberg's best, but at heart, maybe an adventure film. It sits alongside Spielberg's other adventures in a lot of the sequences we get in AI, artificial intelligence, though there is a lot more going on there as well. It's why I like it so much. Another route we have with this premise is a film you and I both loved, Adam, Alex Garland's Ex Machina, which I think takes more of the thriller turn. Maybe mm-hmm. if Koganata was interested in, more interested, I should say, that conspiracy element, the spyware, that's the road that this story could have gone down.
Can I even throw in real quick another Spielberg? Watching the car scenes here, I couldn't help in my head but compare them to Minority Report.
Yeah, there's a similar aesthetic going on there. Although
that is that conspiratorial.
Yeah, that's another conspiracy. Yeah,
has no interest in.
And also what's interesting about those car scenes here in After Yang, now that you say that, is we get just enough to understand that these are self-driving cars,
yes,
possibly going through the same tunnels everywhere on predetermined tracks. That was mm-hmm. my perception, at least, without ever even leaving the car
right.
while the characters are in them, or really exchanging shots aside from a medium shot of one character to a medium shot of another. Mm-hmm. Spielberg, on the other hand, wants to show us the technology
yeah,
and exactly. how it works and how his camera can play within it. So yeah, another distinction there. This is a film that is, compared to those two in particular, more subdued, more sedate, more expressly philosophical. And there is a lot of philosophy in those two other movies, I will say. But man, is this thing in an entirely different register. And yes, if you've seen Columbus, that's probably not a surprise. There are a lot of formal distinctions from mm-hmm. Columbus that we'll probably get into. But in the sense that that was a picture of quiet conversations and careful compositions, you get that here. And here's maybe, Adam, I'm curious to see what you think of this. And we'll have to dance around it a little bit because of spoilers. But I think one way it is also distinct from, say, AI, artificial intelligence, or Ex Machina, is I think this movie is less interested in speculating on the inner life of Yang, played by Justin H. Min. It is interested in that. But I think mm-hmm. it's more interested in what the Homo sapiens are doing with the lives they've been given and
Absolutely.
How Yang makes them reckon with that. Whereas in AI, it is definitely the Haley Joel Osment character who I remember as like, that's whose story we're invested in. And the same thing in Ex Machina, the character played by Alicia Vikander. So I think those two films, that was maybe the priority. And here, Yang is secondary in terms of those philosophical explorations. That was kind of my takeaway. That's a surprising thing for me from the film. And I think to its credit, it's one of the wrinkles Koganata throws in here that really makes me love it on pretty much the same level mm-hmm. as those others.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Just as he or it is providing, for lack of a better word, a service to Mika, the daughter, by being her companion, he's the conduit for discovery on behalf of the parents here, and primarily Jake. But the two climactic scenes, if After Yang has climactic scenes, the emotionally resonant scenes in this film are scenes where the husband and wife, Farrell's character and Turner Smith's character, are separately reflecting on memories of interactions with Yang,
yes.
where they're having an epiphany about something that if they hadn't been able to revisit it in that moment, they probably would have forgotten about completely, despite the fact that they are these quite profound moments, but they don't realize how profound they are until
That's it.
They get to experience them again. And let's face it, Jake is basically a detective in this film. Mm-hmm. The movie doesn't play with any of those tropes, but Yang shuts down. He has to then start going through these memories, really to just see what's on them, but he can't stop himself from being curious and wanting to piece together who Yang was, what Yang was, what Yang valued, what he really did see in their home, and the questions that provokes. He is constantly going to different people or seeking out different people who interacted with him to try to get more information. And I was thinking about how the word meditation is thrown out a lot with films like this. It's a meditation on this and this. And that's usually referring to a movie that is thoughtful and deliberate and is dealing with some of these profound questions. And this movie is that meditation. But for me, it's more a meditation in the sense of the rhythm of the movie. And I watched this movie twice, actually, preparing for this review. And each time I honestly got into a little bit more of a deeper kind of trance with the film. There are big ideas. There are real dramatic stakes. But as you said, it is a very quiet film. Everybody talks almost in a whisper. Mm-hmm. No one really yells. And at first I thought that it was perfect because it was actually a practical thing in that a lot of the conversations we see happening in the home between Jake and Kira, you can imagine that they're talking quietly like parents sometimes do because they're trying to keep it down so that their daughter doesn't hear. But really, that is kind of the tone and the volume level of the entire movie. And it's even telling that there's one scene in this film that I recall where one character gets legitimately angry with another character. And it's when Jake goes to the repair guy and the repair guy isn't happy with Jake's decision, what he wants to do with Yang. And he says something like, "Damn it, I want an explanation." Though he doesn't really get too much louder than I just did, but he grabs a tool.
Yeah.
Actually, as a weapon. And you think, okay, we're going to cross a line here with this movie. And Farrell just says something calmly like, "I don't need to provide an explanation. I want to take Yang." And what happens? We cut to the next scene.
Right.
Confrontation ends.
It's almost like this future is a muffled one for a reason we're never quite given. Going back to the car driving scenes, you don't hear roaring engines. They're just kind of gliding along. We do get occasional exterior shots where there seem to be almost these glass bubble buildings. Mm-hmm. Those are quiet as well. And it even comes down to the production design and costume design. There are warm colors, comfortable materials, again, to
green
kind of
grass.
Yeah, to soak
things we
up.
Don't associate with the future.
It's like soaking up all the sounds that the world would otherwise be producing. So there's a comfort to that, but then it pushes against the same family dynamics that are stressful or anxieties that any family would have today, which kind of punctured this mood as well.
Well, that was one of the notes I jotted down, that no matter where we are in the future and no matter how different this experience might be from the one we have with our families, there are things like bad news happening, something bad happening to the family, the daughter being upset. And so what do? They say, "I've got a surprise for you later." Mm-hmm. And then the parents have to have a discussion about whether or not they should have given her that surprise or promised her that. The same parenting dilemmas are pretty much universal and timeless, I think this movie does suggest.
So you've mentioned or referenced a couple of times the memories, and just to lay it out, basically that's what Jake discovers during the course of these repairs, is that the company, unbeknownst to him, unbeknownst to anyone, has installed this spyware that is taking video snippets. They're like 3 or 4 seconds at a time and recording them inside Yang's hardware, essentially. So that's what he discovers, and he is able to access those and watch those. And it's interesting also, you know, here's another thriller element. He's not only able to access the memories that Yang recorded from his time with their family, but we learn fairly early on that he bought Yang on a secondhand market. Mm-hmm. And so he belonged to someone else before that. And we begin to see snippets of his time with those owners as well. And so that's just another plot element that could be totally used for some sort of conspiracy or thriller elements, mm-hmm. right? And without getting too far down the road there, we can just say it follows the same pattern of being thoughtful, informing the story, definitely having dramatic elements to it, but not yanking it into some heightened arena that it wasn't before. And I definitely want to talk about those memories in a formal way, because this is one of the distinctions, I think, from Columbus, which, as I said, was just mostly beautifully composed static shots of the two main characters against the amazing architecture in mm-hmm. Columbus, Indiana. And here we get these memories. Jake puts on these glasses, which allows him to access them. And at first it's this black depth with pinpoints of light that we kind of zoom from one to the other. Mm-hmm. And we begin to see 3 or 4 seconds. And then Koganata he's also the editor, serves as the editor on this film, which is crucial here because eventually we fall into these montages, which are just the things that Yang, I was never quite clear if he chose that these things were worth recording or if these, the memories Jake chose to watch. But us in the audience, at least, we get thrown is too strong of a word for this movie. We get settled into this montage of things like, the first image we get where the family is posing for a photo, Yang's taking the photo and they beckon mm-hmm. him to join them, right? That's one thing we get. We get Yang looking at himself in a mirror. We get a shot of a Japanese red maple in the family's courtyard. We get snippets of Haley Lou Richardson from Columbus, a character she plays, which connects with those earlier memories. And all of these, what they reminded me of is another film, quite different in the terms of its heightened drama, Pixar Soul, one of my favorite films of that year. But the way these little moments of life, 3 or 4 seconds at a time, are keys to epiphanies. Definitely in Soul, we have that moment of the fluttering whirlybird maple seeds. And here we get a snippet of cherry blossoms floating in the air. That's when it first came to mind for me. But just formally, how after Yang employs these memories, I think is so incredibly effective. And again, just distinctive from a lot of what we get in Columbus.
Yeah, for sure. And I think we can really get into some of those aesthetic choices as well. I do want to talk about the memory aspect, because I think there's enough ambiguity to it, and there's plenty of ambiguity to this film, plenty of aspects of this world and these characters that Koganata doesn't want to spell out for us. I think it's up for interpretation, but where I land is more that these are the things Yang himself remembered as mm-hmm. opposed to just the things Jake was choosing.
Okay.
And it didn't even really connect with me until the second time. And as I said, I still think it's up for interpretation to an extent, but that to me makes it so much more fascinating. Go back to so many sci-fi films that deal with this topic, Blade Runner, for example, when we talk about replicants and that incredible Roy Batty speech at the end, seeing sea beams glitter, you know, and tears in rain, they'll be gone forever. This idea that those memories, when he goes, those memories go. And if I have those memories and I feel the same pain that humans feel, then am I not human? And I think Koganata here is wrestling with something similar in terms of memory, which is he isn't just a recording device, as I thought maybe he was going to be. He isn't just documenting. That spyware isn't just shooting every aspect of every moment of his life.
Yeah.
Whether or not it's something that he is consciously doing, Yang, choosing to remember moments, or somehow it's unconscious and he's tapping into his own human-like capacity to remember. But we don't pick and choose the things we want to remember. Sometimes the things we as humans deliberately say, I don't want to ever forget this moment. I don't want to forget this smell. It doesn't matter. It dissipates. It goes away, right? And the most innocuous things, the most mundane things, and we see some of that here too.
Yes.
Just looking at spider webs or looking at Jake and Kira as they're sharing kind of a tender moment on the couch. Those are the things we actually remember whether we want to or not. That said, there's something fascinating about what is the opening of this film and what they return to multiple times, which is that family portrait
mm-hmm.
that Yang eventually joins. He's setting up the camera. And when we see it, maybe for a third time or whatever it is later in the film, there's a moment where we actually see it then from a different perspective as more of an observer, and we get to look at Yang, and the moment that we have only seen focused on Jake and the family, and he says, "What are you doing?" We don't know why he's really saying it. He says, "What are you doing? Get in the picture."
Yeah.
He's clearly hesitating and pausing. Only later do we see the camera show what Yang is doing, and he is deliberating. He is pausing, and it's as if in that moment he's saying, "I want to remember this."
He's pressing record. I'm with you. I think he's, if he doesn't have a record button, I do think it is a choice, which, you know, that brings us back to, and that opening scene of him deciding whether or not to join the family brings us back to the movie being interested in his inner life. So I do want to reiterate, I definitely think that is one of the film's concerns. And how about the little touch, again, ambiguous, but when we first see that family photo sequence starts the film, as I said, did you notice how there's a snap, like the picture's taken and then it's upside down?
Mm-hmm.
We don't return to that again.
No.
But I wonder if that's almost a little clue as to what we're talking about here, that that's indicating the choice was made there by Yang to remember that moment. And you're right. Like we don't always have command over what we're going to remember. You mentioned smell, which plays so much a part of it. And that brings us to maybe the scene of the film, the tea conversation between Yang and Jake. So Jake runs this artisanal tea shop. He's obsessed with tea. And even in the home, he's constantly steeping tea. And so we get this conversation between the two of them where Yang asks Jake, "Why are you so fascinated about tea? What is it about it?" You know? And this goes back to, again, what I think is maybe the primary concern of the film is Jake realizing he's given his whole life to tea, but he's maybe, at least this was my impression, he's never sat down and really asked himself that question. He's studied tea, he's studied the history, the methods, he enjoys drinking it, and he's never really considered this deeply until Yang asks him about it. And this is a moment, another moment of epiphany, of Jake's dawning consciousness, this newfound awareness of the world around him, and it connects to smell. I mean, I'm pretty obsessed with tea myself, and I rarely have English breakfast because I'm a little snobbier than that. But when I do have English breakfast, I'm immediately taken back to Sunday afternoons with my mom and dad. My mom would always serve tea. She would make Sunday dinner for us. And she's been gone for 7 years now. We haven't done that tradition in that time with her, obviously. Every time I sit down to a cup of English breakfast tea, if I close my eyes and just smell it, I'm there. I'm in that room. And so that is just another element that this movie is playing with, how our memories can be triggered by things that are out of our control. And Yang is a figure to kind of push those to the foreground. Not even necessarily is that his programming or what he wants to do, but just by asking these questions, he starts to prompt that consciousness. And then here's the key where the film showing us the memories works. By Jake revisiting that conversation is where they burst through the surface. You know, just having the conversation, Jake may never have fully kind of emerged with that epiphany. But when he revisits it by watching the snippets, that's when it bursts through. That's when it sinks in. That's when he starts asking the things you were just talking about, Adam. How can I start to not only remember what is worth remembering, but valuing those things in the moment I'm first experiencing them?
Yeah. And those moments are the convergence of a few different perspectives happening.
It's
Yang's point of view in terms of what he is seeing and hearing. There's sometimes this omniscient viewpoint that we get of the dialogue happening. There's what Colin Farrell is processing as he's seeing it play out. And then there's his recollection of it actually happening.
Which is not the same.
It's not the same. And it's the subtle layers here you see. You notice that when he's watching the memory of that snapshot play out, we actually see Jake first going over and looking at the photo of it, the image of it. And I got the sense that he was replaying it first in his own mind. What we're seeing is not the recording. It's him replaying his recollection of it. And then, of course, later he's going to see the version as it was recorded.
It's the formalism is just so brilliant in this sequence. The images, as you're describing, and also the sound, because as Jake talks, certain phrases he says are replayed on the soundtrack, like echoes.
And there are differences sometimes.
There are differences in his intonation. And I think that's getting at what you were describing. Sometimes we are hearing Jake as recorded, and sometimes we are hearing Jake as he thinks he said it in his own memory. So when I wrote about the movie, I described it as this confluence of biased recall and the historical record. And that's everything we've said probably sounds incredibly complicated. And the genius of the way this sequence is crafted is it is of a piece with all of the other ways this movie is experienced that we've described. It's soft. It's quiet. You glide through it. There is ambiguity, but you never feel completely confused or lost. No. It just kind of wraps itself around you like the whole movie does, even though all this formal complication is going on.
Yeah. And I wanted to go back to that, actually, just that rhythm of this film, the kind of soothing cinema that it is. It is deliberate. It's not frenetic at all in terms of camera movement or pacing, but it's also not super static. It's not about long takes. And the editing, I think you mentioned it, Koganata here is the editor as well. And he offers these wonderful elisions and punctuations that just add some really compelling formal elements and draw you in without changing overall kind of the gentleness of this film. And you mentioned one of the examples I was going to name, that photograph. And then on the click, on the shutter click, it goes upside down for a second. But then also in an early scene, right on the moment where Kira says family in a conversation with Jake, it's right after that word that we get a quick cut to the next scene. Most of these transitions are fairly deliberate, and there are moments like that, again, those punctuations that are obviously deliberate and that are drawing attention to words like family. A good example, as minor as it is, of not wasting time with transitions. Kira says, you need to get Mika to school, and right on that cut, he's not walking into the room. He's not doing other things. It's instantly on him going, come on, we got to go. There are those moments, again, where it just kind of speeds up at it just the right pace, but without taking us out of the overall mood. And the scene you mentioned, the tea scene, is, if not the showcase scene in this film, it's definitely number two. And I'll tell you what the other one would be in a second, though you can probably guess. But I do love that you hear Jake, you hear Farrell doing an impression of a Bavarian man.
There's this part in the film. It's a great part where the man is explaining to his German friend why it's so difficult for him to describe the taste of tea. He says there's no language for it. You know, there are no words to adequately express the mysterious nature of tea. And his German friend, who's just standing right beside him with a cup of tea, says, yes, but I imagine things like you are walking through a forest and there are leaves on the ground and it just had rained and the rain has stopped and it's damp and you walk and somehow that is all in this tea.
This one's for the cinephiles for sure.
It is. And in the moment, I didn't know if this was real or not, what he was describing, or this was a made-up movie from a past century. But then I looked it up, and I actually ended up watching it on Canopy, the Les Blank documentary, All in This Tea. He's describing a real movie in a real moment, and he quotes actually Werner Herzog perfectly in that moment. But what struck me about that scene, and there is a scene that mirrors it later, as I mentioned earlier, with Kira. They both get their moment to reflect on a conversation with Yang. And in these instances, all of a sudden the camera switches to more of a handheld approach, something we don't get at all in Columbus, as I recall. Very carefully composed shots, these tableaus, static. And here, it's not wild. It's not one of the Bourne movies by any stretch of the imagination, but Koganata is closer. It's a little bit more intimate. It's a little bit more urgent. It does suggest that kind of fractured sense of perspective that we spoke to that I think is so crucial in those scenes. So that is Koganata there very clearly utilizing a little bit of a different cinematic technique in order to heighten those scenes. And I don't know that this film is one most would watch and describe as being too meta. But when you have Koganata, who, as we know, is not only a filmmaker, but a film essayist and someone who has been very thoughtful about cinema and dissecting the work of various revered filmmakers, it doesn't shock me anyway that documentary, the Les Blank film we mentioned, might have been an inspiration for that amazing scene we described discussing tea, that this idea of being a watcher, of documenting these moments and being able to look at other human beings interact, seeing how they look back at you, seeing how they look at a camera, processing that somehow makes us understand a little bit more about ourselves and the world. And I don't think it's by accident. Maybe this is my best evidence, Josh, that when he finishes his first sequence, that first montage going through Yang's memories, his daughter wakes up and comes and checks on him, and she says, "Daddy, are you watching a movie?"
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he says, "Yes, of course," because he doesn't want to get into the details. But he says, "Yeah, just a little documentary."
I don't think it's too meta at all, because as you said, it works completely for the scene, even if you don't have any reference for what he might be. Mm-hmm. You have to actually go searching for it if you don't know offhand. So it's not distracting at all that he's using that documentary as a reference point. I like the word you use there to describe some of these techniques, punctuations. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, for some people who might be thinking, well, that's great for the two of them, this thing sounds like it would put me to sleep, let me emphasize the two boldest punctuations in the movie. And the one might be what you were thinking of, Adam, the opening credits sequence.
Opening
right?
credits. Yeah.
Go for it. What were you going to say about that? It's just so delightful.
It's so delightful. And I'm going to make a case for it as something quite profound, but in terms of just pure enjoyment as well, it's the most energetic scene in the film. I'm already writing down notes for our wrap party when we're going to look back at this year. And you think about potential scenes of the year, maybe potential openings, though, despite the fact that it's the credits, it's not really the exact beginning of the film. Music moment.
Oh, yeah.
For sure.
Oh, yeah.
It has to be a contender. But here's what I love about that sequence. It was the one I was saying might be the best sequence in the film. And it's one where we see different families engaging in this. Maybe it's sort of a weekly ritual. I don't know how often it happens, but it's clearly some type of television program, mm-hmm. where they interact with it, and it's a competition, and they dance, synchronized dancing,
yeah.
as a family, but they're being judged. They're being eliminated. They have to be so perfectly in sync with each other that whoever or whatever is watching is eliminating families as they go. And there's just something so beautiful and poignant about it, because it isn't just showing us, this is one of those things that became only really clear on the second watch. It's not just showing us random families. It's actually showing us only people we are going to see
yeah.
again later in the film.
Yep.
It's showing us the main characters. Now, we're going to meet some characters that we're not going to meet again in the film. Family members of characters like the repair guy, who we're never otherwise going to see. But it's his family. It's the museum curator's mm-hmm. family. It's the family next door, played by Clifton Collins, and his family. And then it's our main family. And
including Yang, notably.
Including Yang, exactly.
He's part of the routine.
And something about meeting those people before we actually do meet them in the film proper, I just think is fascinating. But it also suggests that despite whatever differences they have, despite whatever different experiences they have in life day to day, this is this unifying experience. And they're all engaged in the same action. Other characters in this movie, it gets back to this idea I set up at the beginning too, of the peacefulness of the film. They're not antagonists. They're not even merely supporting characters. In this world that Koganada has built, just in this sequence, they're all connected and they're all part of something.
Well, and aesthetically too, what I love about it is it steps apart from so much of what we've gotten or we will get, because each family gets its own bold color block background. So it's not like we're just seeing them in their living rooms, you know, we're almost seeing them in their own music video. It's like we're seeing them in their mm-hmm. own heads, what they think yep. they look like as they're doing this routine. And they're like bright pinks or greens or blues. I don't remember exactly. But again, very different from the muted tones that we're getting otherwise. And then the other bold move involves music as well. And this is one of Yang's memories. It goes back to the Haley Lou Richardson character. We see a couple times, 3 or 4 seconds of her at a nightclub, and she's just singing along to this woman who's singing from the stage we never see, because again, this is Yang's perspective and he's just looking at the Haley Lou Richardson character. But we do hear the lyrics and they're repeated and they're, I wanna be.
Yeah.
And again, they apply, of course, to Yang. That's the first place we want to apply them, because these are the sorts of AI stories we're used to. It's all about the AI. But what we come to learn is how much those lyrics apply to the Haley Lou Richardson character.
Yeah.
How much they apply to Jake.
Who's just kind of drifting.
Yeah. Apply to every other, again, homo sapien who we meet. And speaking of, you know, I went down the all in this tea rabbit hole too for to figure out what was going on there. Man, did I go down one for this song, because it's so wonderful and how it's used. It's called Glide. This version is a cover by Mitski. The original version was in the 2001 film All About Lily Chow Chow, which I did not see, which I guess is about a fictional pop star, Japanese pop star. So there are many layers here of artifice and identity, which also, as you were describing in the tea documentary, play thematically with what's going on here. But I actually like this. I listened to the original song. I actually like this Mitski cover even better. And again, it's a bold moment of, not in this case color, but sound, maybe, that stands apart from so much of what we get in After Yang. So this is not a snooze. Even if you're not a sucker for it like you and I might be, Adam, no matter what, it has these moments that give you a little jolt of you see a jolt of extra creativity, or I should just say bolder. I'll go back to bolder creativity and then what the rest of the movie maybe shows that does make this just incredible on so many layers.
Yeah, I loved the use of Mitski here, and coming off a week where you had high praise for the Batman score by Michael Giacchino, Asuka here, this score, I think, is really a wonder.
Yeah, really ambient.
Yeah, it is. And I noted this last week when we were talking about the Batman and the unrecognizable Colin Farrell performance as the Penguin, and how he's doing very, very different work here. And I don't know that we've seen Farrell on screen ever be so subtle and be so restrained and in tempo with this material. And it does actually open up for me a question I have about this film and a question I have about the character. And it's one that I hope to get to ask Koganada at some point. I think he's going to come back on the show. We had such a good time talking to him back when Columbus came out. This idea of grief that I think the movie very much does want to portray. And on one hand, when we think of grief, especially if we think of it in terms of a parent potentially losing a child, you imagine most people responding in a way that is very demonstrative, it is very emotional, that is very pain-filled. And what we get here, despite the fact that we get the sense that Yang really was a part of this family and really was like a big brother to Mika, they don't behave, Jake and Kira don't behave as if they have just lost a child of their own, or at least, again, the way I think we would expect parents to behave in that moment. But that doesn't mean they're not grieving. And I think about the scene with Jake sitting on a bench the day they go out to first seek out repairs, and he's just sitting with Mika on a bench, and you get this sense of quiet contemplation and processing. And I think it's what's driving this investigation, if you will. It's him trying to process how he feels actually about Yang and the impact that he did have on the family, and whether or not he did fully appreciate the contributions that Yang made towards the family, which is all a roundabout way of saying, Josh, that I do think Koganada, and I think that character, is exploring grief. It's just a different type of grief than we're probably used to seeing on screen. And of course, that makes sense in a world where this is like a son to him, but also a machine.
Yeah.
And how do we deal with grief in that type of situation? There isn't a set answer to that.
I think grief is definitely at play, mortality as well. I think that's the crux of the conversation that Yang has with Kira. That's probably Jodie Turner-Smith's standout scene, mm-hmm. is that conversation. But yeah, Ferrell, fantastic here in this quiet but kind of firm register as in this role, the detective, as you put it. He's going to go on my list. You know, you talked about our rap party categories. He's on my list of, you know, best lead performances. I think I'm going to put Justin H. Min on there as Yang as well, because what mm-hmm. a tricky part where, you know, these are always tricky parts when you're playing these AI characters who have to somehow show they're not human yet make us feel humanly towards them. I think he passes that bar while also doing a third thing, which relates to, you know, my understanding of this movie about by being about the people first. He's kind of the motivator for all mm-hmm. of these epiphanies. And that is a role that he has to play, which he does really well. So on top of all the other things, you know, this movie does so well that we've praised, I would definitely include the performances too.
After Yang is currently out in limited release, it is also on Showtime. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, we would love to hear from you. Feedback at filmspotting.net. You can also find us over on Twitter or on Facebook at Filmspotting and at Larson on Film.
Did a Mel Brooks movie survive the first round? How far behind am I in the prediction contest? I've got many questions about film spotting madness. Adam has the answers when we come back. Stay with us.
Well, anyway, she goes as white. So you haven't ever thought to?
What?
I'm asking if you ever thought of passing, Rena.
Ruth Negga with Tessa Thompson in last year's Passing from director Rebecca Hall. When Oscar nominations were announced last month, Negga's performance was among the most frequently cited in the category of snub. She did win an Independent Spirit Award last weekend for the performance, as did fellow snubs. Snubbies, Josh? What are we going with
there? Snubbies.
Okay. Snubbies. Simon Rex. We love Simon Rex in Sean Baker's Red Rocket. Taylor Page for Zola. Maggie Gyllenhaal's The Lost Daughter won Best Screenplay. It also won Best Director and Best Picture. Gyllenhaal, alas, only nominated in the screenplay category by the Academy.
I mean, those acting wins, that pretty much looked like my CFCA ballot, so yeah. That's good to hear.
Okay, Independent Spirit Awards, they got it right. On next week's show, we've got our Oscars special. It's our picks for who will win, we have no idea, who should win, and who should have been nominated. And we do try to make this a little more challenging, that last category anyway. We do have to drop one of the actual nominees. We can't just say, how dare they not nominate this person. We got to make, in some instances, a tough decision on someone to omit. Sometimes it's not a tough decision at all. And sometimes we have homework to do in order to get to the point to make that tough decision. And that's where I'm at right now, Josh.
Yeah, I'm going to say it now so that I actually do it. The one I'm committed to catching up with is Belfast, which I know you were lukewarm on.
Yes.
But I have, I'm actually leading an adult education session at my church on Sunday on the Oscars. And I have a feeling if I don't see Belfast, I will be the only one who hasn't seen Belfast with that group. And that I would look a little silly then. So,
okay. Speaking of looking a little silly, he always makes us feel that way. Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune will be on hand, as he usually is, for our Oscar special. A quick note about where you can find some of these Oscar-nominated films if you have homework to do. West Side Story, Drive My Car, they just hit HBO Max last weekend. West Side Story also on Disney Plus, though I think friend of the show Brett Merriman tweeted something about this, that one version is decidedly a higher def quality.
Interesting.
Yeah. So Google that if you want to make sure you're watching the best looking version of that really nice looking film, if you have both platforms available to you. The other Best Picture nominees, along with West Side Story and Drive My Car, are Nightmare Alley, which is on HBO Max and Hulu. See it. More people. I know we both feel this way, Josh. You need to see that Guillermo del Toro film. Power of the Dog is on Netflix, as is Don't Look Up, Adam McKay's film. I still need to watch. Coda's on Apple TV Plus. Here's some more homework for me. King Richard.
Yeah.
I have seen Belfast. I have seen Dune, of course, talked about it here on the show. And Richard, Belfast, and Dune are available to rent on most platforms. Licorice Pizza is kind of the tough one. The PTA, my beloved Licorice Pizza, available for purchase, but not yet for rental. So you have to be pretty dedicated and willing to throw down some cash.
Worth a purchase?
I think it probably is, but that's also easy for me. Easy for me to say when I not only really quite like the film, but I already saw it.
Right. You know what you're getting.
Along with the Oscars, we'll have more Film Spotting Madness Best of the 70s, Round 2 results, and Sweet 16 matchups.
Want to keep you informed on what's going on with our sister podcast, The Next Picture Show. They are pairing Steven Soderbergh's Kimmy with 1998's Run, Lola, Run from director Tom Tykwer. Your Next Picture Show hosts are Tasha Robinson, Keith Phipps, Scott Tobias, and Genevieve Kosky. New episodes post every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts. Get more information at nextpictureshow.net. So we have Oscars, homework, Adam. We also, you're done with this. It's too late for me to do more Film Spotting Madness Best of the 70s homework, but we did have homework. We did. Jaws was not part of my Film Spotting Madness homework. I watched it anyway again this weekend. Took another look at Jaws, the umpteenth look at Jaws, for good reason, though. As I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, that's the film we're going to be doing this year at Ebert Interruptus. This is 4 days with one film, a frame at a time, as part of the Conference on World Affairs. I've been doing it for a couple of years now, and yes, it's going to be Jaws. First time for Ebert Interruptus in 4 decades, I think, that Spielberg will be done. Also, to align with the show, maybe, possibly, we'll be breaking down the Film Spotting Madness champ. I don't know. We're going to get to Madness results. We'll see. Mm-hmm. I think it does have a shot. I'm going to have a couple of guests joining me. As always, Boulder Weekly's Michael J. Casey will be there to run the film. Walter Chaw, great Denver-based film critic. I'm sure many listeners are familiar with his work. I just talked to him this past week. He's excited to come and join us for one of the days. And we always do a Film Spotting meetup as well sometime during this week. I've already heard from Jonathan Anderson, Scott Lunt. A couple of people have been there in previous years. They hope to both be out there again. So this is April 6th through 9, Conference of World Affairs at the University of Colorado Boulder. We'll link to more details in the show notes for that Film Spotting meetup. Maybe follow me on social media and I'll put out some news as that develops, probably a little bit closer to the event. That's at Larson on Film on Twitter and on Facebook.
This is blasphemy. This is madness.
This is absolute madness.
Spare this madness.
But this is absolute madness, Ambassador. Why should you build such a thing?
Madness. This is Sparta!
So behind the scenes at Film Spotting Madness headquarters, producer Sam says it's pretty much like the tournament scene from Karate Kid. You're the best. It's just playing on a loop. Josh.
He just feeds off it, doesn't he?
Yep, yep. First things first, round two of Film Spotting Madness Best of the 70s is live right now. To vote, go to filmspotting.net. Voting closes every Monday at 11 a.m. Central Time. So depending on when you're hearing this, we say it's live right now. Well, it might be closed if you're listening past Monday, March 14th. But that just means a new round is probably live because new rounds go live every Tuesday. We do give our family members over on Patreon a first shot at those polls. And before we get into first round results, we have to hear. It's an annual tradition. We got to hear from the godfather of Film Spotting Madness, the listener who gave us the idea many years ago, Josh, much to your chagrin. It's Mike Merrigan from Dover, New Hampshire.
Hello, Adam, Josh, Sam, and Film Spotting Nation. It's Madness founding father, Mike Merrigan. I'm positive that our Best of the 70s tournament is the hardest one we've ever done. Round one definitely had its own slate of impossible choices. I think Adam was absolutely right to single out Badlands versus Blazing Saddles, but I think the toughest part of this year's tournament is that there are so many films that could rightfully claim a spot in the Final Four. In years past, it felt like we had a pretty good idea of who our Final Four was going to be, and our prediction bracket showed that. This year, it feels like the field is wide open. If you told me that Close Encounters loses to Annie Hall in round two, I'd believe you. If you told me that it made it all the way to the Final Four, I'd believe that too. So I think this is absolutely the hardest tournament we've ever done. As the guy who lost our bracket challenge this year, I certainly hope I can get it figured out before all is said and done. Best of luck to everybody. I hope everybody had a great round one, except maybe for Larson. I got to tell you, I'm ready for him to be at the backside of this thing again. So good luck to everybody else.
Shots fired there, Josh Larson.
Yeah, well, he's really rooting for this because he made a little side bet with me, actually, between the two of us. If he does better than me, I've got to come on his podcast. Now, he might regret that when I actually get on the show and torpedo it, but that's where things are right now.
Okay. Well, he is the godfather of Film Spotting Madness. He's also the reigning loser of Film Spotting Madness. He does have some homework to do, and I don't even remember what the losing film was. What did he have to watch, and has he watched it yet?
Oh, yeah. He's supposed to give us a review. That's how it goes. I don't remember that. There had to be a Sandler film from last year. Netflix film.
Okay, Merrigan, we haven't forgotten.
Yeah.
We will search the Film Spotting Madness archives, but we are going to look at some of the first round results, and we're going to start with the biggest blowouts and get to the tightest matchups, and we'll also give you a couple of upsets and a few other matchups along the way where we got some great feedback from listeners. We're not going to go through all 32 matchups. You can see those results over at filmspotting.net/madness. First, we'll just mention Francis Ford Coppola. He entered round one with four films in Madness. They all survived.
All right.
The first round. Robert Altman started with three titles. Only one made it to round two. Scorsese came into the tournament with three films. Two survived the first round reaping. And other major directors with a couple films in the tournament are Spielberg, Mel Brooks, George Lucas, Sidney Lumet, Terrence Malick, Stanley Kubrick, and William Friedkin. Let's see who did advance to the round of 32. I'll do the first couple here, Josh. The blowout. So going from the largest margin of victory to the smallest, but all of these gaps were pretty wide. The number one seed, The Godfather, did behead your beloved Black Stallion.
You know what? Yeah, 95% to 5%, it looks like. I saw this coming, so I snuck that beautiful stallion out of the stable, painted a donkey, and put it in there. So okay. I'm afraid the Black Stallion still lives.
It's safe. Okay. Number three seed, Spielberg's Jaws, did defeat Killer of Sheep. We're just destroying animals here in Film Spotting Madness. The shark took down the sheep 94% to 6%.
I mean, as much as I love Killer of Sheep, I'm rooting for Jaws to go all the way here again to tie in with Ebert Interruptus. So this is fine for me.
This next one had to make you feel good.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just to pile more on John Badham's Saturday Night Fever, it went down to Ridley Scott's Alien, 94% to 6%.
Yeah, no upsets here.
All right, here's another Coppola win. Apocalypse Now took down Truffaut's Day for Night. Pretty decisive, 92% to 8%. And let's stick with Coppola, The Godfather Part Two. Another win here. It was the number four seed. It took down Fassbender's Ali, Fear Eats the Soul, 91% to 9% for that one.
Poor Elaine May and The Heartbreak Kid losing to one of my favorite films of the 70s, Alan J. Pakula's All the President's Men, 88% to 12%. Also from 76, like All the President's Men, we've got Scorsese's Taxi Driver took down Nicholas Roeg's Don't Look Now, 87% to 13%.
This next one was the narrowest win among the top four seeds. Number two seed Star Wars did win over Bruce Lee's Enter the Dragon, but it was 87% to 13%. So strong showing. I'm going to call that a strong showing against Star Wars.
Fair enough. Spielberg's Close Encounters of the Third Kind took down The Outlaw Josie Wales, also 87 to 13%. And George Lucas, fortunately, he's got Star Wars here. American Graffiti did advance to the tournament, took down Grey Gardens in a play-in matchup, lost to Chinatown, 85% to 15%.
one more here among the real wipeouts. And this is another win for Al Pacino, really, but it is Sidney Lumet's Dog Day Afternoon beating Peter Yates, Breaking Away, 82% to 18%.
So then we'll go to The Nail Biters, the films where there was a relatively close margin of victory. And I thought this one would be pretty tough. I did predict that David Lynch's Eraserhead would triumph over Richard Donner's Superman the Movie. And that's how it came out. But Josh, just 57% to 43%. Trent Robb says, really pitting the kid me against the adult me. In fifth grade, I loved Superman so much, a friend and I hid in the theater between shows so that we could watch it twice in a row. Just watched Eraserhead last week at age 53. Loved it. Old me is taking this one, Trent says.
Older and wiser, Trent. All right, you guys paired up A Woman Under the Influence versus Scenes from a Marriage. Predictably, this was tight as well, but Cassavetes takes it over Bergman, 52% to 48%. That's a difference of 40 votes, I'm told.
Our last tight matchup is one that I predicted would be close. I didn't know how to call it. I kind of didn't know how to pick it myself between these two films. And we'll get into our results here in a second. I was wrong. I did think that George Romero's zombie classic Dawn of the Dead would ultimately take down Terrence Malick's Days of Heaven. But Days of Heaven won out. Only 60 votes between them, but Days of Heaven did win 52% to 48%, Josh.
I think I switched that one. When we were talking on air, I think I was with you and might have predicted Dawn of the Dead, but before I submitted my prediction ballot, I think I might have switched that one. We'll find out. We'll get to that.
Okay, we do have a few upsets here, and some of them we can quibble with. And what I mean by that is, technically they're upsets in that when the Film Spotting Madness Committee, Sam and myself, spent days and days agonizing over the seeding, which we don't reveal in the final bracket, but it's not too hard to figure out when you're looking at a matchup, the one on top is the favorite. There are some instances, we'll get to at least one here, where Sam and I realistically thought the bottom film would in fact win, so it's hard to call it an upset, but we just felt that the movie that was the favorite deserved that acclaim, deserved to have a shot, deserved to be a higher seed. So some expected, but some unexpected. This one, expected. I predicted it, but man, does it tear me apart. It's not how I voted. Monty Python and the Holy Grail, not just defeating Michael Cimino's The Deer Hunter, but kind of crushing it, 68% to 32%.
We heard from a couple of listeners on this one. Anthony Morris said, this is the only one I had to think about. Neil Mitchell, You Bastards, almost any other matchup, and Deer Hunter wins, but Holy Grail, comedic Python perfection, only way I can vote. And then here's Jordan Jersick. The Deer Hunter is an excellent film, to be sure, but I have approximately zero interest in ever revisiting it.
I can see why some may say that the Holy Grail is a little bit more rewatchable than The Deer Hunter. That brings us to Hal Ashby's Harold and Maude over Robert Altman's McCabe and Mrs. Miller. And Sophie, my daughter, is so mad at me about this because I think she only missed two in round one. And she was throwing some at me before she submitted the bracket. And I said, Sophie, you know you shouldn't listen to me. I don't know how well I'm going to do. And some of these are a toss-up for me. But I really do think McCabe is going to win. I think that movie just is so beloved among cinephiles that it's going to win out despite the adoration for that cult classic that is Hal Ashby's Harold and Maude. And she listened to me and she's still mad at me because Harold and Maude kind of cruised to victory, Josh, 60 to 40.
You know who Sophie should listen to?
You?
Me. I'm pretty sure I had Harold and Maude here. We also heard from Eric Layer. This is the madness in a nutshell, like choosing between your children, the one who you know is a better person overall, or the one who you secretly love just a little more, maybe because of their faults. I got to meet Eric's kids. They sound interesting. Even the songwriters featured in both films share similar issues. Cohen is clearly the deeper artist, but Stevens is more consistently uplifting, even if, or perhaps because he skirts the line of sentimentality. In the end, it comes down to overall impact on my adolescence versus later in life appreciation. Harold and Maude introduced a way of accepting alienation and unifying it with love, something I, like many teenagers, so needed in my life, which is why I'm voting for it.
Well, 60% of you out there were in line with Eric. How about this one, Josh? This is really going to tear you up. We have the 1976 Best Picture winner, Rocky, the underdog, going up against Peter Bogdanovich's The Last Picture Show. And yes, very in character here in early voting, quite a gap. Last Picture Show, the favorite, running away with it. And you know what? Stallone and Rocky just had the stamina, Josh. They had the hunger.
Terrible.
They had the determination. And they came back and won 54 to 46%.
I can hear him bellowing now, and I don't like it.
He's going to shadow box his way into round two.
Oh, no.
Okay, more Terrence Malick. He got into round two with Days of Heaven, the film I actually like more. His 1973 debut, Badlands, going up against Mel Brooks' Blazing Saddles, another one I predicted would be close, would be tough. As much as it hurt me, I picked Badlands, and I like Blazing Saddles quite a bit, but I went with Badlands. That's my heart choosing in terms of the movie I thought would triumph. I did go with Blazing Saddles, and that's how it came out, Josh, 52 to 48.
Yeah, I think this is the Malick I predicted wouldn't make the cut. I think I might have reversed flipped those two last minute. Here's a comment from Patrick Banks. In the spirit of corrupt 1920s Kansas City politics, I returned to cast a second ballot for Blazing Saddles. What? What?
Since the system doesn't allow that. He's lying.
Since I somehow convinced my mom to take me to see it when I was in second grade because it had the guy from Willy Wonka, I have loved this very smart, very irreverent comedy. It is the one film that is on all of my mobile devices that I turn to when I need a smile. Badlands is great, but it doesn't have Lily von Stupp. That, I mean,
you can't argue with that. Okay. A few other matchups of note. Kubrick's A Clockwork Orange went up against Toby Hooper's The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and it was a massacre. Clockwork Orange did win. The Droogs took down the Leatherface family, 73% to 27%. Here's Jeremy Webner Berman. He says, both of these were blind spots going into Madness, so I've seen them both recently. A Clockwork Orange is quite entertaining and surprisingly funny, but Texas Chainsaw was one of the most gripping horror movies I've ever seen. The way that you, along with Sally, quickly realize that everyone and everything in this little backwoods world is designed to entrap, torture, and devour is quite literally horrifying. And then there's a bunch of capital letters here that make up a sound, Josh, and it's been a while since I've seen Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Do you know what this sound is supposed to portend?
It's been a long time for me as well. I'm assuming this is some awful scream that emanates from someone in the movie. That's going to be my assumption.
Yeah. Question for Josh. I believe this is coming from our producer, Sam, in Wisconsin. He'd like to know, is Texas Chainsaw on the Fear No Evil watch list?
Note, Sam, the title of the book is Fear Not. So I gotta work on my branding there.
You do.
But yes, I think it is. Thank you for asking, because I actually put on Twitter, the whole book's going to be broken down by subgenre, and I wasn't quite sure where to put Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Where would you put it, Adam, just off the top of your head? Like a subgenre of horror, you know? Like, it's not a creature feature. It's not a ghost story. What would you say?
Cannibalism?
Well, I mean, that's probably a sub-subgenre. Yeah.
People getting hung on hooks. Is that a subgenre?
If it is, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. I think where I'm going to cover it is in the slasher chapter. I did a Twitter poll of sorts, and most responses, there were a lot of varied ones. Most people said they'd put it in the slasher category. So yeah, I'm going to give it another look, and I will report back on what means, because I think that's what Jeremy is writing here.
Yeah, or is that a chainsaw starting up? I don't know. There's still time to rebrand to Fear No Evil, by the way. Robert Altman's Nashville went up against Martin Scorsese's The Last Waltz, and the higher seed here did win out, 69% to 31%.
Here's Rob Shames. I know Nashville is going to win, and that's okay because it's a great movie, but The Last Waltz is a desert island movie for me. I first encountered it in college when my friends and I would play it before going out for a night while having a few adult beverages. It's the ultimate hangout movie. But now, as a semi-respectable adult with my college years way behind me, I still love it. Part of it is simply the music. I absolutely adore the band, and well, you have to love the music to love a concert movie. But more broadly, I think it captures almost the precise moment in time when classic rock ended. Soon punk rock and then hair bands would emerge and render this music old. The film somehow seems to know that and strikes a melancholy tone as it works its way through the melange of music styles that contributed to or exemplified the rock music of the era: blues, soul, Tin Pan Alley, folk, a mixture of all of the above. It's the ultimate swan song to not only a band that I love, but a genre of music and a culture that, frankly, I wish I was old enough to experience firsthand. It is truly the beginning of the beginning of the end of the beginning.
Well said by Rob. And yes, I, too, love The Last Waltz, despite the fact that I know I'm supposed to say, as a smart film person, that Nashville is the better film. I can't throw The Last Waltz in the incinerator, but that's where it's going. I'm going to have to squirrel away a copy somehow, keep it from Sam, who is actually the person who throws them all into the fire, by the way. He's the enemy.
I was wondering whose job that was. Okay, I like it.
Couple more for you. Sidney Lumet's Network went up against another Altman here, The Long Goodbye, and it is goodbye to this Altman film. Man, I love both of these films. 66% to 35%.
Here's Andrew Alton from Illinois. I said a very bad word when I saw this one. For the first time, I can finally say "you monsters" and that I no longer enjoy the madness. Is that the first "you monsters" we've gotten
in
feedback?
It's the first one.
I know we've seen it on Twitter and social, but yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for that, Andrew. We have finally the Adams Anguish matchup. Woody Allen's Annie Hall versus Bob Fosse's All That Jazz. Two of my top four films on Letterboxd. All That Jazz is defeated, 62-38.
Here's Jason Ballou. There was a time in my life, not too long ago even, where Annie Hall was a top four favorite of mine on Letterboxd. And here I am voting against it in the first round of madness for a movie I just watched as part of my homework. I hope I don't regret my decision once Alvy goes in the incinerator.
That brings us to round two, 16 fresh matchups, again, available now over at filmspotting.net/madness. And I think I'll start, Josh, throwing a couple at you here. Again, the toughest to pick and the toughest to predict. I've got my toughest to pick, and there were only two. There were a lot that gave me anxiety in round one of madness. In round two, I zoomed through them. 14 of the matchups, knew right away, no hesitation where I was going. These two, at this moment, I still don't really know how I'm going to vote, and I'm going to have to force myself to make a decision, one that will not involve probably listening to you, certainly on at least one of these two, because I know this one's easy, easy for Josh Larson. The Exorcist, The Network.
Yeah, I mean, here I'm going to discredit any authority I have of writing a book about horror films because I have a few issues with The Exorcist. There's no way, even if I set those aside, it's close to the film that Network is.
Okay. I think it is quite close to the film Network is, but maybe just not quite close enough. Network is still the one I love more, and it's getting my pick. Oh, I'm so bummed. How about another horror film? Halloween. John Carpenter's Halloween in round two going up against Werner Herzog.
Oh, man.
Aguirre, The Wrath of God.
Oh, tell me where you're going first. This is the first I've seen this, so I've got to wrap my mind around this.
I think, I'm not going to look because I just want to live in the mystery, Josh, but I think when we discussed Halloween in the past couple of years here on the show, I think it was a Halloween episode where we did a Sacred Cow on that Carpenter film. I probably gave it 4.5 stars, definitely gave it at least 4. I think it's a great film. But I think I rated Aguirre a 5-star movie.
That sounds right.
I think Aguirre is my choice, despite the fact that I don't think it's going to win.
Yeah. And I would be dishonest. I have come around to really, really like Halloween. It was on that show, actually, that revisit. But having always liked and really thinking of Aguirre as a definitive film, a definitive Herzog film, it would be dishonest for me to vote for Halloween over it. So I'm going to go Aguirre.
How do you think this one's going to play out, though? You think Halloween's got this like 70-30? Oh,
I mean, this is a really hard one because you do have the cinephile pick, right? The snob pick, which I think we both just went with. So that's us.
But Halloween fits that bill, too.
This is what I'm going to say. Halloween has both the popularity element and, you know, real appreciation among cinephiles. So I think probably that would give Halloween the edge, but I wouldn't be shocked if Aguirre takes it.
Well, in early voting, one of them is winning, and I swear I did not look at this until just now. One of them's winning 67-33.
Ooh, okay.
So some votes to make up, let's say, if, like us, you're a Werner Herzog fan. Those were my two toughest to pick. Now, here's the toughest to predict. And one of my three is one of the two I just mentioned. I really am not sure how it's going to come out between Network and The Exorcist, knowing how much love there is for that Friedkin film.
Yeah, I think it's The Exorcist. I mean, you know, maybe Network gets an extra bump because we just did a revisiting of that, I think, last year. But Exorcist, I think, is even more beloved than Halloween. So I would go that direction.
Okay. What about another Friedkin? He has a chance to have both of his films going out here in round two. French Connection, a Best Picture winner, going up against the juggernaut that is Mel Brooks and Blazing Saddles.
Let me ask you, though sometimes I think I overvalue this strategy, did Young Frankenstein make it to round two?
Young Frankenstein did make it.
Okay, so there's a world, if people take in the whole bracket before they choose, which is kind of what I do, but I got to realize, I think not everyone does it that way. I would then maybe be easier to vote against Blazing Saddles here because I would choose Young Frankenstein, but I'm pulling it up and Young Frankenstein is against Alien.
It's
against
Alien. Oh, yeah. It's not a tough one to predict, unfortunately.
No, so Alien's going to take that. So I think in this one, French Connection will knock off Blazing Saddles. But again, maybe I'm overvaluing people kind of not wanting to knock off two films from the same director.
Okay. So far, just glanced at the voting. A lot of votes in, but still a lot of votes to come. And in fact, these two are really tight.
Okay.
They are not going to be in the blowout category. They're going to be in the nail biters. We'll see about my last toughest to predict choice here. And I can't believe I'm saying this, but after seeing how well it did in round one, knowing the way comedy seems to be playing, I do think that it's really tough to call Monty Python and the Holy Grail versus Sidney Lumet's Dog Day Afternoon.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think that is a hard one. And I'm going to go sentimental here. I love to see comedy getting its due and say that Monty Python might be able to pull this one off.
Yeah, I really can't believe it. I definitely have Dog Day Afternoon advancing on my bracket. Another close one, not quite as close so far as the other two I mentioned, but someone is going to start yelling Attica in the streets and commenting on injustice because Dog Day Afternoon is in a fight for its life against Monty Python. Now, you have gone to the page. You have looked at the 16 matchups. I've just covered four unique matchups there in my two categories. Any others that stand out to you, Josh, that you want to bring up as far as super easy, super hard, or you want to call Sam and I monsters?
The hardest for me, a quick glance here, is Alien versus Young Frankenstein, the one I just discovered. Yeah, I mean, this is the monstrous pairing of two movies that are so different and doing such different things so well that there's hardly any way you could imagine pairing them against each other. Do I give it to Young Frankenstein because we have aliens? I mean, that's one way to think through this. I know for most people, this isn't a choice. For most people, it wasn't for me. It's just Alien, but I'm going to chew on this one for a little bit. I'll say that.
And I do love Young Frankenstein. Xenomorphs, they can't sing and dance the way Frankenstein's monster can.
See,
but
this is what I'm talking about.
Right. Any others that stand out?
I don't know how I can verbalize this, but I'm going to right now, I hope you can sense the joy I'm feeling by voting for Taxi Driver over Rocky. It just happened. Yeah. It yeah. just happened.
It just, oh, it, oh that you felt loved so it. Good. The delight of relitigating the 1977 Ooh. Academy Awards. And you gave the best picture rightfully to Taxi Driver over Rocky, mm-hmm. huh?
Yep. There you go.
Okay. If only you had that power. You can vote now in all 16 second round matchups of Film Spotting Madness at filmspotting.net/madness. That's also where you can check out the bracket and the complete list of titles that made the tournament, which does bring us to our prediction contest. Had almost 800 unique brackets filled out this year. And of course, for the first time ever since starting the prediction challenge, we're having some technical difficulties. And our provider is supposed to be helping us out. If you look at your bracket, you look at your score, it's not accurate.
Oh, no.
It doesn't reflect the actual numbers, and I don't have a solve for it. I am going to need our friends at Challenge to come through, Josh, and make sure that there's legitimacy to this bracket challenge.
Now, if the next thing you say is that you're in last place, I'm going to be really suspicious.
I am not in last place.
Okay, all right. In fact, I believe you that there are issues.
Even with the scoring issues, I'm in first place among our little internal bracket. But first, we always love to touch base every round with the listener leader. And even though the scoring is wrong and he doesn't show up that way, I think he shows up in second place. How about this? Our winner right now through one round, I hope I get this somewhat close, Oscari Vaino, or Vaino. He is a 19-year-old listener from Finland. He says, I've been enjoying the show for over 2 years. Glad to be mentioned on the show, even if I'm not sure I could call myself a savant of anything to do with 70s movies, as I have seen less than half of the movies in the tournament. Looking forward to those blind spots. Thanks for the great show, and can't wait for more episodes to come. So, Oscari is kind of
wow
that person you knew in high school who went ahead and filled out a bracket, just circled random winners yeah. or went by the uniform colors and then ended up winning March Madness. Oscari is in the lead. A perfect bracket so far.
Holy cow.
32 out of 32 right in round one.
Congratulations at all those diligent listeners who watched 30 movies for this
yeah.
in preparation are tearing their hair out.
They are
now over you. 30, but still,
some watch like 70.
Congratulations to you, Oscari.
Yeah. In terms of our internal contest, again, where our rankings are overall are probably slightly off. They are slightly off. But at least in terms of gauging how we match up against each other, these are the numbers we have to go with. I am in first place. I missed two. As I mentioned, I thought Romero would win out over Malick. He did not. Days of Heaven advances to round two. I thought McCabe would take down Maude. Neither of those two misses, though, Josh, affect future rounds. Didn't have them advancing very far. I'm still looking pretty good.
Sitting pretty.
77th overall, give or take, is where I stand among the 800 brackets predicted. Sam Van Halgren, our producer, he's in 212th place. He also missed two. He had predicted Dawn over Days of Heaven like me. He thought Badlands would beat Blazing Saddles, and here's the problem. Sam had Badlands advancing in the next round.
Uh-oh.
So he's in a little bit of trouble. What about Josh Larson? Well, Josh, you are in third. You missed three.
Okay.
So a score of 29 so far.
I'm you comfortable did, in this third place. It's where I'd like to live.
You had Carrie beating the conversation.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay. Didn't work out that way for you, Josh.
I also forget how to spell my name. I mean, I have issues, Adam.
You did think that Superman would beat Eraserhead. Didn't happen. And how about this? Predicting Solaris Tarkovsky would take down Young Frankenstein. None of those happened, but none of those affect future rounds. So you're doing all right.
Okay. I'll take that. Yeah. What was I thinking with the Solaris thing?
I don't know.
Maybe, but no, here's where I was thinking, because that means I did have Blazing Saddles over
Badlands,
right? So I did the dumb thing and was like, well, then
only one comedy,
only one Brooks. I got to get rid of that strategy. I think I got to dump that.
It works okay for your picks, not so much for the
predictions.
Yes. Yeah. Mike Merrigan, he is in 373rd place and he's struggling a little bit.
Oh, Mike.
He missed four. And here's the problem. He had not only Badlands advancing to the Sweet 16, he had Five Easy Pieces advancing to the Sweet 16. They both went out in round one.
Well, Mike, maybe I won't be coming on the podcast. A little early to tell, but we'll see.
Yeah, we will see. Now, the prizes for the winner, we don't have prizes for the winner. We just have the penalty for the loser. The loser has to watch the next Adam Sandler movie on Netflix, except as we have noted, the next Adam Sandler movie on Netflix actually looks kind of good. It's an NBA-themed movie called Hustle, so you might just throw this whole tournament, Josh.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I'm going to go that far, but the NBA talk does remind me, just to touch base again with our Finnish listener, Oskari Vaino.
Yeah.
You know, Lauri Markkanen, the Finnish basketball player with the Chicago Bulls, who, you know, left to join the Cavaliers.
Yeah, he's a Cav now, right?
He's a Cav now. I know he's doing fine over there, but I was okay with that change of scenery for Lauri. Mm-hmm. I hope Lauri has good things for himself there in Cleveland, because his time had run out in Chicago.
I hope everyone will be patient with us as we talk about the NBA. I also hope you'll be patient with us as we try to figure out our technical difficulties with Challenge and we get the numbers right. Here's the thing. You know that Sam is going to go through all 800 brackets if he has to and hand score them. So it's fine.
Oh, I don't know. Is Sam going to make it out of this year's tournament sane?
I don't know.
I'm a little worried. The level of involvement was always alarming from our very first year.
Right.
It's getting to concerning rates here. Sam, just don't try to fix Challenge, at least. Just let Challenge do their work.
Yeah, he's leaving that to me.
Okay.
He's leaving it to me and Challenge. And you know what? I think we'll pull through, Josh. That's our show.
It is? You don't want to keep talking about Finnish basketball players?
No, not for now. Though I will throw out one reminder, filmspotting.net/madness.
If you want to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Letterboxd, you can find us at FilmSpotting and at Larson on Film. In the show archives at FilmSpotting.net, you can find reviews, interviews, and top fives going back to 2005. And yes, the website is also where you can vote in round two of Film Spotting Madness. To order show t-shirts or other merch, visit FilmSpotting.net/shop. And you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter at FilmSpotting.net/newsletter.
Out on digital this weekend, Pixar's Turning Red, that's on Disney Plus. The Adam Project, Ryan Reynolds, is a time-traveling fighter pilot who teams up with his 12-year-old self to save the future. Zoe Saldana, Mark Ruffalo, Catherine Keener are in that, which comes to Netflix. Next week, we're not going to talk about those movies, though we are, of course, kind of eager to see Turning Red and may, in fact, talk about that in upcoming bonus content for our Film Spotting family members. No, we are going to preview the following weekend's Oscars. Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune will join us for that.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Betty Lavendero. Thanks also to Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.